This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week, we help you catch up on the headlines from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, December 4th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. The coronavirus pandemic has us all struggling. Struggling with loneliness, with work and childcare, and for some people, struggling just to put food on the table. State officials have millions of dollars in food benefits that they want to distribute to the people who need it most, but the Trump administration is preventing that. Here with more is WESA's Kate Giamarisi, who reports on the economic impact of the pandemic. Kate, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Liz.
In your story, you introduced us to Jennifer Eber. Who is she and what kinds of challenges is she facing?
Well, Jennifer is a woman who lives just outside of Pittsburgh in McKees Rocks. She was laid off from her job earlier this year because of the pandemic, and she is looking for work. But in the meantime, she is on unemployment and also receiving food stamps. And unfortunately, as many people receiving that assistance know, that is not typically enough to get people through the month, to meet all their food needs in a month. And it is also not really enough to eat a healthy diet.
The Families First Coronavirus Response Act, passed by Congress in March, allows for all food stamp recipients to receive additional aid. So why isn't Jennifer getting a little bit extra for food?
Well, so the way that the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the food stamp program, the way they've interpreted the law is they've given some families some additional funds, but not the lowest income people who were already receiving basically the maximum amount of food assistance per month. And as a lot of people have said, you know, this really doesn't seem to make any sense. Why would you give, you know, more help to the people that make more money, and the lowest income people, you're not giving any help at all? And that's what's led to this litigation.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand this. Families that are poorer or larger or some combination of those factors may already be receiving the maximum benefit, and thus, according to this rule, are not eligible to receive the extra benefit passed by Congress in March. But families that have more money and or fewer dependents aren't receiving the maximum benefit already, and so they are able to collect this extra benefit?
That's correct.
You mentioned litigation on this matter. Two Pennsylvanians actually sued the Trump administration over this rule. What's the status of that suit?
So, yeah, that suit was filed back in July. It is still pending in federal court. But back in September, a judge ordered the USDA to pay this extra assistance while the litigation is ongoing. But the agency has resisted doing that. Now, most people are hoping that this is all going to be sorted out and that the USDA will reverse course in January when the new administration comes in. But that doesn't really help people who need food right now. This affects, you know, our story focused on one woman, but this affects quite a lot of people. This is about 40% of the households in Pennsylvania that receive food assistance, and that's about 700,000 people.
Kate, thanks for your reporting, and I look forward to talking with you again as this case makes its way through the courts, and or maybe we have an update on the policy in January under the Biden administration.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
It's been 5 years since 200 people in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, learned they'd have to move out of their apartment complex to make way for new development. Maybe you've heard stories like this before, about people being pushed out of neighborhoods they've called home for years.
We felt that the neighbors, we were being pulled apart.
About government officials leaping into the fray.
This is not gray. This is black and white.
About how cities try to balance growth and equity.
For who? Who are you making it better for? You ain't making it better for me.
But what happened in Pittsburgh in 2015 wasn't the problem. It was the symptom.
If we're going to really embrace equity in this region, it is going to take a pretty seismic shift in the way that we are thinking.
WESA's new podcast, Land and Power, explores how one place becomes another and what that means for the people who used to call it home. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or at landandpowerpod.com.
One of Pittsburgh's strengths is its vibrant nonprofit community, and many of those organizations depend on local tax dollars to stay afloat. The Allegheny Regional Asset District, or RAD, funnels a portion of sales taxes to area nonprofits, and earlier this year, RAD cut grant funding amid concerns about how the coronavirus pandemic would affect revenue. This week, RAD restored much of that funding. WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll is here with more. Bill, thanks for being on Explainer.
Nice to be here, Liz.
What's the importance of RAD funding for local nonprofits?
Well, RAD has a budget of about $100 million to work with, and it funds just about 100 local groups. Most of the money goes to libraries, like the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh gets about two-thirds of its operating budget from RAD. The park system, like the Allegheny County Parks, for instance, gets also a huge chunk of its operating funds from RAD. They also help fund the city parks, a few other parks in a few other municipalities in the county. And then there's a pool of money that's maybe $12, $13 million that goes to local arts and culture groups, everybody from the symphony to small theater companies. Some of those grants are not huge, but to a company with a small budget, you know, even a few thousand dollars is a big deal. So they make a big difference.
Did RAD end up seeing the sharp revenue decline that was anticipated?
At first, yes. As you can imagine, March, April, May, when there was an almost complete shutdown of the local retail economy, there was a big plunge there. And that's what they were reacting to in May when they voted to reduce operating grants across the board by about 20%, which is a big cut. But then starting in like June, when things started to, stores started to open back up, basically, it rebounded to really almost normal levels, which is kind of astonishing, right? So June, July, August, September, we were getting pretty much the same sales tax revenue from that 1% Allegheny County sales tax as we had gotten the previous year.
I know organizations that depend on ticket sales, like theater groups and museums, have been hit especially hard because, you know, for them, that's a big chunk of their revenue is this earned revenue. How far does this RAD funding go to helping those groups stay afloat?
Well, what RAD did this week was it restored funding basically to 2020 levels minus about 5%. So except for the parks funding, which is restored to previous levels, everybody's getting what they would have gotten before, you know, like the Symphony, Pittsburgh Public Theater, Children's Museum, Carnegie Library, et cetera, are all getting what they got before minus about 5%. And they're grateful to get that, obviously. Some of these groups rely a lot more on earned income, that is from things like ticket sales, than others do. For instance, the Carnegie Library basically has no earned income, except a little bit from, you know, penalties if you have a late book fee or something. Other groups, like arts groups, rely less on earned income than you might think. The average for an arts group is around a third of their income comes from things like ticket sales, merchandising, stuff like that. So they're really heavily dependent on most of these groups on things like RAD money, but also foundations, individual giving, things like that. So that's one reason that they're able to weather the storm, even though they don't have, they're not selling tickets or putting on shows.
Are you feeling hopeful that Pittsburgh's nonprofit and specifically some of these nonprofit arts groups are going to be able to weather the storm and that they're going to be, you know, ready to entertain us in person sometime next year when the time comes?
Yeah, it seems like that. And you say next year. I've been talking to some of these folks about what they're hoping to see, you know, with the vaccine on the horizon and all those things. And they're hopeful by, you know, summer or certainly fall that they can start to resume in-person live performances, which is the big problem, right? Like galleries and museums are open. They're not seeing the attendance that they would have. You know, the Carnegie Museum's open, the Frick Museum is open, all those things. It's really these live performance venues that are having the trouble because they can't do anything at all. I have to say, at this point, I'm a lot more worried about for-profit performance venues, you know, like concert venues and things like that, because they don't get this kind of you know, support from tax money or anything like that. And we've already seen several of them close during the pandemic, like the Rex Theater, for instance, on the South Side had to shut its doors. Yeah, I'd say it looks pretty good, you know, that these nonprofit arts venues are being careful about the resources. They're trying to stay active. They're trying to keep in the public eye with virtual performances. And they seem to have a plan and have a fair degree of confidence that they'll be able to bounce back.
Bill, thanks so much for your reporting.
Sure thing.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
Hanukkah. It's one of my favorite times of the year.
Mine too. The holiday commemorates the rededication of the old temple in Jerusalem, and it's also a symbolic representation of the strength, the resilience of the Jewish people.
Hanukkah Lights celebrates the occasion with stories of the season. I'm Murray Horwitz.
And I'm Susan Stamberg.
Please join us for all new stories on Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
For the past year, WESA's government and accountability reporter Lucy Perkins has been following four Pennsylvania voters from across the political spectrum. This week, in the final installment of our split ticket series, the voters weigh in on the outcome of last month's presidential election. Lucy, welcome back to Explainer.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
Can you just start by reminding us who you talked to?
Yeah, so as you said, I followed these four voters over a year, two Democrats, two Republicans. Our first Democrat is Linda Bishop. She's retired. She's in her 60s, and she's part of this group of women who made headlines right after President Trump was inaugurated back in 2017. These women, largely in the Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania suburbs, started organizing and tried to get Democrats elected to office. So she's been working for the last 4 years to flip Pennsylvania back to blue, which happened this year. And she is based out of Mars, Pennsylvania. The other Democrat in the series is a college student at the University of Pittsburgh. She's a junior now. Her name is Savannah Henry. She is the president of Pitt's Planned Parenthood Club and is pretty progressive. When I first met her last December, she was interested in having Bernie Sanders be the nominee and was not super excited about Biden, but she did end up voting for him. So on the Republican side of things, the two voters I followed are Republican Mary Henze and Republican Ed Swiklinski. Mary is in her 50s and lives in Jefferson Hills. She's been on unemployment and disability for about a decade now. She voted for Obama in 2008 and had been a Democrat for decades, but then just really liked Trump. And so she voted for Trump in 2016 and again this year. And then our fourth voter, Ed Swiklinski, is a Republican. He lives in Bethel Park. He's in his 40s, and he is pretty fiscally conservative. He has voted for some Democrats locally, but voted for President Trump in 2016 and did so again this year. So those are the four voters I profiled. They are kind of across the political spectrum as far as, you know, Democrat to Republican, and there's a pretty big divide between those two camps, of course, but then there are also differentiations between them within their own parties. So I chose those voters because I thought they really represented kind of the different voting groups in Western Pennsylvania.
So what have you learned? What's your main takeaway after spending a year with these voters?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to do this series is because I wanted to create a series where you heard four very different points of view all in the same story every month on a bunch of different issues. And it wasn't just, you know, going to a diner and finding the three random people who happen to be eating there when you arrive and talk to them and try and extrapolate something about how voters in a particular region feel. This was pretty intentional. I wanted these voters to really represent core groups of voters here. And so I think that that part of the series worked. We definitely heard four different perspectives. I went into it calling this series Split Ticket because it seemed to me that the Democrats were pretty far on one side and the Republicans were pretty far on the other side. And I kind of thought that there would be some issues where there was overlap and where they would find common ground, where we didn't think that there would be any, but that didn't really happen. I talked to all the voters and they were grateful to be able to hear other perspectives and everyone felt that they were represented fairly, but there was not really a lot of overlap. There was not very much common ground at all on any issue. And I talked to them about a bunch of different things, you know, from Black Lives Matter protests to climate change, healthcare, gun control, the pandemic, and, you know, President Trump's impeachment. And there was very little common ground. They really kind of stayed in their corners, and there was not much overlap between any of them.
Did anyone at least express interest in reaching across the aisle and finding common ground, finding ways to work together, and urging our representatives in government to work together despite our differences?
No, is the short answer there. You know, some of the voters did say that they found it enlightening to be able to hear another perspective and to kind of be able to get to know someone more fully over the course of a year and not just hear a couple sound bites about how someone who thinks differently than you feels about, you know, the latest headline of the day. So they did appreciate that. Some were definitely interested in connecting with other voters, but it wasn't necessarily because they saw common ground, but because they felt that having a conversation might persuade that voter to think differently and more like the opposite party. This is not a series that ends with tied up, you know, with a beautiful ribbon or anything like that. They're pretty divided. And when the series started, we felt that the country was pretty polarized. And clearly this series illustrates that we're even more polarized than we were in 2019.
And of course, our listeners can find the whole Split Ticket series at our website, WESA.FM. Lucy, thanks so much for your reporting this week and over the past year.
Thank you, Liz.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.